Thank you very much. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker this morning, Dave C.
Good morning, friends. My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. I do like to say that. I like to say that on a daily basis, and it's part and parcel of what I do, because with the head I have, if you take me away from a program of recovery, whatever kind of the illness that still sort of lurks inside me would whisper in my ear and maybe would convince me that I'm not. And I might even get well enough, or believe my own publicity enough, maybe, just maybe, to go out there and try it again. So when I say I'm an alcoholic, I really need to sort of stop and say, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and not just to, as it sometimes does, depending on my busy day, it kind of glibly trips off my tongue, and I'm halfway through my day before I really realise that, you know, I haven't given that really the gravitas that it deserves. Because the truth of my alcoholism is that when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a place where suicide wasn't just an option. It was a real sort of part and parcel of my life. And when any Egypt who could stand back and look at where his life was at that particular stage could see the damage that alcohol had done since the time that I picked it up at 16 years of age. And yet, you know, the madness of my alcoholism was that right to the bitter end, I believed that I was okay. And to the bitter end, I was prepared to pay the price. And the price didn't matter what it was. I was at a meeting last night and I heard somebody talk about, you know, some of the places they'd been and some of the things that they had done. And it just re-emphasised for me that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, was of any value to me when it came to a choice as to whether in fact it was alcohol or this other value. So the stuff that got left on the side were family and friends and children and all that kind of stuff really counted for nothing when it came to a choice between either that or a drink. This is serious hard work here, so I'm going to take off my... And when I say serious hard work, I mean what we talk about here is serious stuff. We can have great fun and we can have a laugh, and the great joy of recovery is about being able to have good fun in this particular process. But this is serious stuff. This is life and death stuff. And the stuff that I hear today and the stuff that I get involved in terms of my daily program is the stuff that maintains me, not just in terms of an element of peace and comfort in who I am and what I am, but also in terms of my very being, my very life. So I wanted to just pay very sort of proper respect to that simple phrase which we use all of the time, which my name is, and I'm an alcoholic, you know, and to understand exactly what it means. What it means for me is that, you know, alcohol assumed, you know, long before I understood anything about addiction or a phenomenon of craving or any of that kind of stuff, what it meant for me is that I liked to drink. And I liked to drink on an ongoing and regular basis. And as the price got dearer and dearer and dearer, it ceased to matter. It became the crucial, main, focal, central core of my life. And then with the great value of our illness of denial, of course, I wasn't able to recognise that. And anybody who dared to mention it to me was gently moved to one side, and I moved on to the next pub, or indeed to the next relationship, or to the next job, or to the next country, or to the next town, or wherever. I was 16 when I picked up a drink, and really, I was ripe for a drink. And I was shy, I was retiring, I was inadequate in how I saw myself. I didn't think very much of me. Didn't very much excel at sports, had plenty of enthusiasm, all right, but generally speaking would have been the last man picked on the team or that kind of stuff. And when I look back into that early days of childhood stuff, I discovered how to lose very gracefully, very quickly. So that if I came last in the race, you know, I could always stick my hand out to the winner and tell him well done, because that's what a man did. And yet inside, you see, there was so much of me wanted to be anybody else, really. I wanted to win and wasn't able to. And I mean, I just used the if you like, the story of the race, as because that's really symbolic in many ways of what was the rest of my life was like before I picked up a drink. You know, that part of me that wanted desperately to fit in and was so discontented in who and what I was that I would have been anybody else. I don't know if any of you remember Audie Murphy. Audie Murphy was a great old film star. It just shows my age. When I was going to the pictures on a Saturday afternoon, and when we would come out of the pictures, everybody wanted to be Audie Murphy or Alan Ladd even. Gosh, I'm getting old. I didn't really care to a large extent. I wanted to be anybody other than who I was. That's how I kind of saw myself. And then, of course, when alcohol moved into me, you know, everything changed. I became Audie Murphy instantly. It was like just instant coffee. You just added the alcohol to me and I became Audie Murphy. I could sing, I could dance, I could tell you funny stories, I could talk to you without blushing. And for the first time in my life, I didn't care. I really didn't care what you thought or how you felt, at least on the surface anyway. And that's how I felt. So alcohol was wonderful for me in that first night. And the first night I got drunk, I was working away from home. I was 17, just short of 17 years of age. And I was working in a holiday camp in Ireland, in Mosny. And I went back to an All-Ireland AA convention since, I might say, and they've no blue plaque on the wall to say Dave Carroll had his first drink here. And to some extent, you know, when I look at the consequences of that first drink there, there really should be a blue plaque on the wall. Probably paid for by the brewing and distillery companies. Because I kept them going for a wee while. And the first night I got drunk, you know, the first night I had a drink, I got drunk. And the first drink I had, I can even remember very, just so well what it was. It was pints of beer sweetened up with baby sham because I didn't like the taste. But I loved the effect. And the first night I got drunk, I ended up in bed with a woman who was old enough to be my mother. I don't remember everything that happened, so I had a blackout. And when I woke up the next morning, there was part of me was absolutely appalled. And that other part of me that sort of said, wow, let's do this again. And I pursued that evening in many respects for 20 years. I chased the buzz of that, that comfortableness in my own skin, which had never been there before for 20 years. And it brought me to the place that it brought all of us. None of us are sitting here because it seems like a good idea. You know, or should I say, none of us sat and came into our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least I certainly didn't, because it seemed like a good idea. I came in because I was battered and beaten and my life was in shambles. Those that were around me were devastated, destroyed really, by the illness of alcoholism in me. I had a mum and a dad, a brother and a sister. I had a wife and three kids. And then you can add on to that the people who loved and cared for me. And all of them were destroyed by the way that I behaved over the period of 20 years. It didn't happen overnight, you know. And that's the other bit that fascinates me. You know, this it's like a creeping paralysis. It kind of snuck up on me, you know, and just destroyed, you know, whatever sense of value, moral or otherwise, that I had. And the unacceptable became normal for me, you know. And if you had said to me in the early days that I would drink in the manner that I drank towards the end, if you told me that I would end up in the kind of scrapes that I was going to end up in, I would have couldn't have seen it. Would have called you a fibber, or worse. And yet the truth is, of course, is that, you know, the unacceptable becomes normal for us. And so we get to the primary purpose of a group. Because my story is such that my rock bottom had taken me to the place where I wanted to die and didn't have the gumption for that. Tried. And like everything else in my life, failed spectacularly. And I ended up sitting in a unit in Dublin in May 1986. And the only reason I was there was because I wanted to be out of trouble. I didn't particularly want to stop drinking because, you know, like a good alcoholic, alcohol was the only thing that gave me any kind of peace, although the elements of peace in my drinking became less and less and less and I'm sure there were minimal by the time I got to the place where I was sitting in a unit. But yet, you see, the great lie that was there, the great untruth of the way of my alcoholism, told me that that I was having great fun. And if you'd had a conversation a week before I tried to take my life, I would have told you that life was grand. You know, that wee man who comes out from the underneath the house when the hurricane's been there and the whole place is in bits, and he turns to his man and says, "Ain't life grand, ma?" That's exactly how I was. Ain't life grand? And I perpetuated that falsehood, that delusion that my life was fine to the bitter end. And I was 12-stepped in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The unit that I was at had two meetings a week, compulsory, whether you were alcoholic or not. And you know, if you want to have a giggle, I wasn't sure. It gives me a giggle. How could I not be sure? And, I sat in that room and I listened to... There was a wee girl did the top table, and she was a very quiet-spoken wee girl, and I didn't hear everything she said. She heard. I didn't hear everything she said. What I did hear was Chapter 5 read out. And at the meetings in Ireland, that's all they ever read out at a meeting is Chapter 5. So I got to know Chapter 5 off by heart, thank God. And I remember one phrase in Chapter 5, you know, from that very first meeting that kind of clunked into the back of my head. You know, and there is one who is all power, and when is God, may you find him now. And I think the despair or desperation that I was in, even if I hadn't really got around to the thought that it was about alcohol, really, just the despair and the desperation, that moment of desperation, I kind of grasped and reached out and grabbed at that. And I remember thinking in that moment that maybe it could be different. Maybe, just maybe, my life could be different. And I listened to the other people share, and I was astounded at the honesty that I heard. And I saw people who were clean and dressed proper, who told stories that I wasn't even sure I could identify with. But what I could see was the before and the after. You know, they told the before and I could see the after. And that's what 12-step me. Just ordinary people doing ordinary stuff in extraordinary times in many ways. And I got telephone numbers. And I got this wonderful bunch of caring, which I really couldn't understand and never could actually put a finger on as to what it was. It was just one human being caring for another, as we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet it was a total anathema to me. Because I never cared about anyone, really. I did at a surface level, but deep down I couldn't really grasp what this unconditional love was about. Mind you, I could sit on a bar stool and I could tell you how much I loved my wife and kids. But I couldn't really tell you how I was behaving. And I couldn't really tell you the fact that I couldn't stand up and go home. I couldn't tell you that kind of stuff. So I had versions of it. A lot of my versions of life, you know, had come from a television set, in truth. You know, we didn't get television until we were 14 in rural Ireland. And, you know, when I saw things like Little House on the Prairie and the Donna Reed Show and I Love Lucy, you know, I immediately recognised that my family wasn't right. My family was perfect. You know, I have a lovely mum who's still alive, and my dad is a number of years dead now. But the truth is, I mean, there was certainly difficulties within the family, and there was an element, I suppose, of what we would call dysfunction, or whatever a modern word for it is. But the truth is, the real problem in my family was me. That was the real problem. And the fact that neither my brother or my sister are alcoholic in any shape or form really kind of points that out in many respects. They grew up with the same mum and dad. So I'm kind of, you know, if I start to blame them for who I am, in some respects, it kind of loses its value in terms of a proof, you know, because they grew up in the same house as I did, the same amount of love and care that was given. Interestingly enough, neither of my parents were alcoholic, but both sets of grandparents would have been very heavy drinkers. Interesting, isn't it, the way it goes around. But for me, the primary purpose of the group in Knocklyon in Temple Ogan, Dublin, was the piece that actually helped me to get sober by the kindness and the love and the care of the people there. And when I was thinking about this, you know, before coming over here, I tried desperately not to project, you know, because when I was privileged to be asked to speak here, you know, immediately, you know, the first thing that kicks in for me is inadequacy. And the second thing that kicks in is arrogance. You know, and then, you know, we sort of get down to the real stuff. You know, I know, you know, that all of this is managed by a loving God, as I understand him, and all I really have to do is to stand up here and open me gob. He looks after it in many respects. I'll tell you a story. Many years ago, I was asked to speak at a convention in Birmingham, and I did a chair on the Saturday morning, and I felt discomforted and dissatisfied, but, you know, just the way it was. And when it was finished, people said, "That's very nice, thanks very much." And the inadequate part of me, which kicked in, said that was no use. Really wasn't much good. And they'd recorded it. And I was sitting at the back with a friend of mine later on in the day, and he said, "Did you buy the tape?" I said, "Much, much too humble to buy the tape." And he said, "So am I, but we bought it, right?" And I was so discomforted the way that it had gone. And again, it just reflects my inadequacy, the deep down sort of stuff that's within me, that when I sat in the car the following morning to go home, I kind of threw the tape into the glove compartment and drove home. But it didn't cost me another thought in many respects. And about 3 months later, this bloke rang me on a Saturday afternoon for a bit of AA business or whatever, as we do. And he said, "Did you ever listen to that tape?" And I said, no, I'm far too humble to have ever listened to the tape. I said, "I listened to it the other day." He said, "You know, it's very good." So I went out to the car and I got the tape and I listened to it, and it was lovely. So the truth is, I don't always know when I'm well or not. So that's why I have a sponsor. And that's why I have a home group. And that's why I have people around me who enable me to sort out — the Irish word for it is shite — in my head. Because I'm so capable of taking even the most simple fact and just squeezing it around. So the Knocklyon group of Alcoholics Anonymous 12-stepped me and fulfilled and introduced me to the concept of their primary purpose, although I wouldn't have been able to use the words at those times. And the other thing that strikes me is this, is that every group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in London alone there are 690 meetings or whatever it is, on a weekly basis. And each one of them has the capacity to 12-step to love and the care, with love and care, the poor Egypt who walks through the door like I did. And yet the other side of the coin is that each group has the opportunity of destroying the opportunity for a suffering alcoholic to get well. That's an awful responsibility. And can I tell you, there are groups that I've attended where I would question how seriously they take the responsibility. I've walked into groups and I stood on my own in a corner because I was a stranger in the group, where people haven't reached out a hand and said, "How you doing?" Now, I'm well enough to be able — I'm big enough and bold enough and brass enough to be able to say, "Yoo-hoo, you know, I'm here," or whatever, or introduce myself or speak. But the truth is that if in my early days I hadn't been shown that great love and that great care and that great sort of, as only we can do it, you know, where that message, that little flicker of hope was taken and was fanned, if you like, and if that hadn't happened to me, I dread to think what would have happened. I don't understand this stuff in many respects. I understand my program as I understand it, you know, to the best of my ability. But I don't understand how the God of my understanding made it possible for me to get sober. Because in truth, you know, when I walked through into that wee group in Knocklyon on a Thursday night, not knowing whether I was alcoholic or not really wanting not to drink again, because the thought of not being able to drink, you know, as we are in early days, for the rest of my life was appalling. So not able to grasp that context or that concept, and yet you people just gathered around me. And the beauty of it was for me, because there's, you know, I don't know whether it's just me or whether it's alcoholism, I certainly have come across it around, is that if you tell me to do something, I have great difficulty. There's a little bit of me that still ranges, it's tied up in me, step six actually, which kind of says, who the hell do you think you are to tell me anything? It's tied up with arrogance and all that kind of stuff. But I was never told. I was encouraged. I was loved. I was moved through a process. I was even allowed to make my own mistakes. Well, now, wasn't that wonderful? And the other great gift is that I wasn't judged. You see, all my life, I had judged me. And I had judged me with the bar set terrible high. You know, because the standards, the only standards that were of any benefit to me were perfection. And because I come a million miles short of perfection, I was a constant failure in my own life. You know, and you people sort of took me and just held me and gave me that time to pull it all together. So I'm ever so grateful for that. And I'm just conscious of time here, because I know we've got a lot of speakers to go. So those of you who know me and know me too well, once I start, I'm difficult enough to shut up, but I'm being responsible here. So I just want to finish with a wee story, which our dear friend Dan, who's since passed on, and many of you knew here and loved. Dan used to tell this story, and I repeat it regularly because it just typifies for me what we're about. And it's about the two old dears who are standing outside the AA meeting, waiting for a bus to come along. And they're watching us lot troop through the doors, 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night or whatever. And one old dear says to the other, what's going on in there, Mary? And Mary says, well, she said, it's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, isn't that wonderful? She says, what do they do? Well, she said, it's very strange, very strange. They all sit around, and then one of them tells this real sad story, and they all laugh. I think that just about says it all for us. There's a great joy of living, there's a great joy of loving in our fellowship, you know, while the program comes from our book and from our text and from the study that we do and the work that we do, for me, the great love of the program is in the people. And it's you people, you know, sort of who deliver the message to me. One last thing, you know, when I was arguing, as I'm prone to do, with my first sponsor many years ago, and he was desperately trying to impress on me. I can't remember what it was at the particular time, but it was obviously very important because I was kicking up against it. And I don't kick up against stuff that's not important. It's only the really important stuff that the rebel part of me kicks against. And he says, come here. He says, tell me this and tell me no more. He said, do you believe that God works through people in AA? And I said, I do. Yeah, absolutely. Because I've been around long enough to hear that. He said, well, then, for God's sake, listen to me. He said, I'm people. Thanks very much.